This week, the Dow Jones Industrials closed at another all-time record high, just shy of 20,000. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone. Your host, Chris Walczak, back with another two big interviews. We have John Williams from ShadowStats, a true rogue, even heretical economist, and then another heretic, Peter Schiff, two of our favorite guests rolled into one big Thanksgiving episode. Peter Schiff, chairman of Schiff Gold, says the Fed is terrified of impending inflation, so these rate hikes, we should have at least one in December and probably one or two more next year, indicates good times ahead for the precious metals. The bond bears are in firm control. U.S. treasuries have collapsed in recent weeks. It will take even more QE for our policymakers to contain that toxic situation, circa 2008-2009. And just as before, that was fantastic news for the metal. Peter Schiff outlines his Euro-Pacific Gold Fund, which continues to outperform underlying indexes. Then respected economist John Williams joins the show from ShadowStats. He says the Great Recession of 2008-2009 is still underway, and you can even make a firm case that the recession started around the year 2000 and we're still stuck, especially when you adjust the numbers for corrected inflation. Ultimately, the economic fallout will impact the global economy, sending the yellow metal to at least 10,000 and likely many-fold that number. The case in point, Venezuela, where one silver coin suddenly buys about $250 worth of groceries. And remember, we'd like to hear your questions and comments. We'll likely have our callers next week. We have a few already lined up. You can reach us at 641-715-3900. You'll need our extension number 5140-49. Again, please jot this down on a post-it note, place it next to your phone, or plug it right into your iPhone, Android, 641-715-3900, extension 5140-49. And Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest must-hear report. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Well, slightly cloudy weather persisted over the precious metals for the third week running as money continued to hemorrhage out of the U.S. treasuries and into the U.S. dollar and U.S. equities. However, by Friday, the greenback pulled back sharply, which contained the selling. In fact, silver finished near the break-even point around $16.52 an ounce, off just over 1%, while gold gave back only about 20, ending at 1.6%, 1190, just shy of that 1200 point. The precious metals XAU, though, finished near break-even, still treading water above an ominous-looking head and shoulders pattern around 79 to 80 area. Let's hope that support holds firmly in the next few weeks. Black gold, though, also bucked the trend, up $1.60, 3.5% a barrel, closing at 48. The dollar rally paused on Friday, as I mentioned, nudging gold and silver higher on thin holiday trading. Traders are watching the Fed funds futures closely and, of course, bond market yields. Each are hinting at higher rates, which, of course, send bond funds into equities, the U.S. dollar, and competing assets. With economic data pointing higher, financial markets generally expect the Fed to raise rates on the December 19th meeting and a couple more times likely next year. There's about a 94% chance of a rate hike in the next few weeks. But of course, the technical outlook on gold is impressive. We've finally reached the 62% Fibonacci level, according to a Bloomberg report. I verified it here. That tends to show some pretty solid support right around the 1172 area. Precious metals, bottom line. Well, the greenback clearly contained the bulls yet again this week. That is, at least until Friday. But the CRB blasted higher, and of course, oil continues to move to the top of its bullish range. Assuming that these trends continue and the dollar is contained, this could be a positive sign on a forward basis. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, visibility still unlimited over the New York Stock Exchange as money continued to flee debt instruments in preference for the risk-on trade. The much larger bond market sent funds into U.S. equities. The Dow Jones Industrials added 284 points, 1.5%, finishing at 19,152 with an earshot of that 20,000 point and not too far from that ominous 24,000 call by Cadillac, you might recall, a couple of decades ago during the go-go 2000 dot-bomb years. The S&P 500 added 31 points, about 1.5%, finishing at 21.13 for the week, while the NASDAQ picked up 77, 1.5%, finishing at 53.98. Well, the Thanksgiving Black Friday shopping results will clearly come in this weekend and give us an idea on how our retailers benefited from impulse and seasonal purchases. Last year's sales were up only about 5.5%, and that will likely be eclipsed sharply this year, which could be another positive for U.S. equities come Monday. I'd like to outline a very interesting book just released by James Rickards here, one of the top forecasters in the world, worked with the DOD, CIA, mentioned in recent episodes. He's calling it his Ice 9 plan, and in this new book, it really looks like one of the most important must-read of the new year of 2017. This is the stocking stuffer, I think, for everyone. He says the two big-to-fail banks that were involved in the 2008 crisis are now about 40% bigger today, which makes them maybe too big to bail. All of the risky derivative bets are even riskier today, and combined debt has increased $10 trillion, doubled since 2008. We have now about a $20 trillion national debt. But unlike 2008-2009, Jim Rickards says there's very little that our policymakers can do to protect against another crisis. Bottom line on U.S. equities. Well, the volatility VIX index continues to return to the mean. Fear has just evaporated. And our 7-indicator sentiment index, well, shows greed continuing to eclipse fear. The risk on trade remains strong for the time being. Obviously, the traditionally strong holiday Thanksgiving market did again pay off this year. Coming up after the break, more Gold Seek Radio with our two big guests and Robert Ian. Peter Schiff, chairman of Schiff Gold, SchiffGold.com, author of several bestsellers and radio host. Welcome back.
Well, it's always great to be on Gold Seek Radio.
We appreciate that. Wanted to start off today with the big dollar rally. You know, following the presidential election, many investors, institutions caught off guard, probably two more interest rate hikes, according to the Fed funds futures next year. There's been a lot of adjustments since then. Do you think that this risk on trade is overdone at this point? And what might that mean for precious metals investors, please?
Well, I think the idea that higher inflation is somehow a negative for gold is completely wrong. I do agree that the markets are correct in that inflation will be increasing, especially given the stimulus that, you know, a Republican Congress and President Trump may in fact deliver in the form of some tax cuts, some increased government spending. As a result of that, we're going to have larger deficits, and the Fed is going to have to monetize those deficits. Inflation is going to be, you know, is going to be moving higher. But that is a good thing for gold. It's not a bad thing for gold. What people are saying is that, oh, because we're going to have a higher inflation, the Fed is going to have to raise rates to combat that higher inflation, and those higher rates are going to be good for the dollar, and a strong dollar are going to hurt gold. But even if we do get one or two rate hikes over the next several years, quarter point hikes, that will not be sufficient to restrain the inflationary forces that would be building in the economy. And so even if rates go up slightly, inflation will go up much more. And so real interest rates in an inflationary environment will be falling, not rising. And that is very, very negative for the dollar, and it's extremely positive for gold. So I think the markets are jumping to the wrong conclusion here.
So if I understand you correctly, what you're really saying is that, you know, maybe we hit 1% up to 1.5%, what have you, over the next few years. Really, that's just a drop in the bucket as far as offsetting the actual impact of inflation on the economy and thus real interest rates.
Yeah, and I doubt, Chris, I doubt that they're even going to get that high. You're talking about 1.5%, and we'll have a hard time just getting through 1% on the short-term rates. But look at what's already happening to the long end. This could be the beginning of a huge collapse in the bond market. And, you know, Trump thinks, or the markets think, that we could get away with this fiscal stimulus. You know, the Fed's going to have to step up big league, right? They're going to have to do massive quantitative easing because somebody's got to buy all these bonds. And right now, nobody wants to do it. Everybody wants to unload their treasuries. And so if we're going to send the budget deficit up to the stratosphere, who's going to buy those bonds? So, you know, you have all these people saying, oh, you know, now that we're finally going to get that fiscal stimulus. We don't need the monetary stimulus anymore. No, we need it more than ever, because the only way we can have the fiscal stimulus is if we get an even bigger dose of monetary stimulus, because somebody's got to buy all those bonds to make those deficits possible. And the only institution that has a big enough checkbook to do it would be the Fed.
Exactly. And we saw that, of course, around 2008, 2009, for about a year or so afterwards. But, you know, the Fed officials, policymakers have been sitting on their hands since then. We've watched their balance sheet sit in limbo, if you will, for about 2 years now. You would seem to think that if this bond collapse were to continue, they'd have little choice but to prop up the economy and the sectors by buying up toxic debt. And we could see that figure, what is it, around $4 trillion balloon, maybe to the next level higher?
Oh, yeah. I mean, remember, too, the Fed has been bluffing for years their intention to shrink that balance sheet. Meanwhile, it hasn't shrunk at all. And it's going to have to grow dramatically in order to enable the larger deficits of the future. And especially if you look at what's happening abroad, foreign central banks are major sellers of U.S. treasuries. I don't know where the private demand is going to come from. If everybody believes that inflation is going to pick up, why would you want to loan money to the U.S. treasury for 30 years at 3%? So, you know, I don't think there's going to be any real private buyers until we get a significant increase in rates. But the problem is we can't afford a significant increase in rates because we can't afford to pay. So I think the Fed is going to have to, you know, I mean, they shouldn't, but they will end up buying those bonds. So people who are buying dollars, they're doing the wrong thing. They should be doing the reverse.
You think they should be selling dollars and that this could all be just a false rally, a false breakout? I mean, you do have to admit the greenback touching nearly a decade, but multi-year highs.
Yeah, well, it's at, 13, 14-year high. So it is more than a decade high in the dollar index, although it is a marginal high. I mean, we're slightly above the high we were, a year or so ago. But I think the dollar is in very dangerous territory up here. I mean, it's a lot of speculators who I think have gotten caught. Maybe they're being stopped out of some trades that they were in. Because, again, it's a misunderstanding. More inflation is not good for the dollar. It means the dollar is losing purchasing power. So when a currency is losing purchasing power, that doesn't make it more valuable. It makes it less valuable. The only way that higher inflation could be perceived as a positive for a currency is if you believe the Fed will aggressively fight to contain the inflation. I think our Fed will surrender and inflation will win. And inflation running out of control is not good for the currency. And when people realize that the Fed is all bark and no bite when it comes to inflation fighting, there will be a big reversal in the dollar's momentum. And, you know, I think people should be selling into it right now.
I mean, obviously, the housing sector, very sensitive to interest rate increases. There's been considerable boost to the economy, right, from real estate. If we see higher rates, that would seem to pull it right out from underneath the table. I mean, we could be looking at even more toxic debt then for Fed officials to purchase up. And what would be the stimulus? What's going to be the economic growth that keeps stocks, U.S. equities, at record highs?
Well, it can only come from more money printing. That's, you know, I mean, not real economic growth. It's just inflation that's propping up stock prices. I mean, that's what's been propping them up all along. And, you know, you've got all these people that are thinking, well, you know, it'll be like Ronald Reagan. You know, we'll get tax cuts and stimulus and the market will go up. But, you know, when Reagan was elected, we had been in a bear market for 15 years. Stocks were very cheap. And they didn't even start going up until, I think, the third year of the Reagan presidency, second or third year. We went through a pretty bad recession. But, of course, interest rates started way up and inflation was very high. And so we were able to bring it down. But we're now, you know, we've got interest rates that have no place to go but up. And we have stock market that is already extremely overvalued. So it's hard to see a repeat of the experience then, especially since, you know, when Reagan jacked up the deficits, we went from about 30% debt to GDP to about 50%. We're already at 105%. So we can't grow the debt now the way we did it then because we can't possibly finance it. You know, so this is a different world that we're living in. And if we want to move from a bubble to a real economy, the bubble's got to pop. And that means there's going to be a lot of short-term pain in order to, you know, turn this corner. But nobody's ready for that.
For several years, as precious metals corrected, we saw commodities slowly decline along with West Texas Intermediate crude for the most part. We continue to find support in commodities, in the CRB, in crude oil, despite, you know, the dollar breakout. Do you see that as a positive divergence within the markets for the yellow metal and silver?
Yeah, well, I think that you're going to see a move up in commodities because of increased inflationary pressures brought up by central banks all around the world. And certainly if the Federal Reserve is going to have to print even more money to monetize even larger deficits in the wake of the fiscal stimulus coming from tax cuts and increased government spending to fulfill, you know, the political ambitions of the Republican Congress and the promises from Donald Trump. Yeah, I mean, there's going to be a lot more inflation, and so commodity prices are going to rise substantially as paper currencies lose value, particularly the dollar. And as the dollar is weak, I mean, if the dollar is losing value relative to other currencies, that is generally the best environment for commodities.
Now, we've just, as you mentioned, seen a bond rout. Do you think that we could see the equities return to the mean? Because obviously bonds are not likely to rally back up to where they were. There has to be a meeting point somewhere. Where do you expect those funds to flow?
Yeah, well, if the bond market continues to sell off, stocks are going to ultimately follow. I mean, because interest rates are a primary component of stock market valuations. But also, companies are borrowers of money, and if interest rates rise, so too does the cost of, you know, continuing that to finance that debt. And a lot of companies have debt that rolls over, it matures, and they reissue it. There's been a lot of corporate share, you know, buybacks over the years financed with debt. So there are a lot of problems for the stock market if interest rates keep rising. So if they do, the market's going to roll over. But, you know, to the extent that the Federal Reserve doesn't hike rates in December, we'll see, or indicates that their rate hiking is over, there could be some kind of a bounce in the market. But I still think that the long end of the market could be under some real pressure here unless the Fed launches another round of quantitative easing where they commit to buying more bonds on the long end and putting a floor beneath the price. If they don't do that, I think that this, you know, decline is going to continue, and at some point it is going to weigh heavily on the stock market and certainly the real estate market too, which we, you know, we just had a big number came out today on home sales, but this was, you know, from a couple months ago. But now you've got mortgage rates that have gone since the election from about 3.5 or just below 3.5 on a 30-year fix to now about 4.125, 4.25. Even though those are still low rates, you know, historically, they're not nearly as low as they were. And if you've got record high home prices and now mortgage rates start to go up, that makes homes that much less affordable. And people are already struggling because, you know, their jobs are not, you know, they don't have the incomes and the cost of living has been going up. So the main prop for the housing market has been the really, really low mortgage rates. And now those rates are not as low as they were, but they can certainly keep rising. I would not be surprised to see the rate north of 5% by the time Trump is elected. And maybe even we could be at 6% or more, you know, early next year. And, you know, I just don't see how we could support the current home structure. I think we'd have to have a 20%, 30% decline in real estate prices if mortgage rates were at 6%. And, you know, what's that going to do to the banks, you know, when all their collateral collapses? How many people will still make their mortgage payment if the value of their house goes down? I mean, so this is some very serious stuff that's going to be happening if rates keep rising.
Exactly. I'd keep my eye on a new housing starts. That seems to be most closely correlated with the overall Case-Shiller index, I think, nationally. It's a pretty good proxy for the market. You know, you talk about the inauguration in July. Where will investors park their funds?
Look at what happened the last time that we transitioned from Democrats to Republicans. It was when Clinton left and Bush came in. And, you know, during the latter part of the Clinton presidency, that we had a huge dollar rally. You know, commodities were down, emerging markets were clobbered. But when the Clinton surpluses turned into Bush deficits, the dollar began a huge bear market, a 7-year, 8-year decline. The dollar index went from 120 down to 70. And, you know, gold went from under 300 to 1,000. Oil went from 20 to 150. And the emerging markets took off. And so I think if we get another exodus from the dollar and the U.S. bond market, that that's where investors are going to go. They're going to go back into commodities, into emerging markets, into foreign currencies, into precious metals, and I think in an even bigger way than they did last time.
It certainly seems as though investors have maybe overreacted on the downside, given this new probability of higher rates in 2017. You know, if we look historically at the 70s, most of our listeners will know that rates were climbing most of during the 70s, and precious metals soared in one of the most spectacular bull markets in history. Do you see potential for history to rhyme this time?
Well, certainly the big catalyst for the move up in commodities in the 70s was the dollar, you know, going off the gold standard. And so the U.S. dollar being marked down accordingly, because it used to be backed by gold and now it was no longer backed by anything. And so there was no more restraint on the ability of the U.S. government to go into debt. And there was no real value behind our currency. And so there was a substantial decline. At the end of that, you know, we still maintained the reserve currency status of the dollar, even though it was no longer backed by gold. It was still accepted at a reduced rate, right? It was marked down, but then the world continued to accept it as a reserve currency. I think the next step in this evolution will be to reject the dollar as a reserve currency. I mean, it should have been rejected in the 70s, but instead the world held on to it, and that is the source of a lot of these major imbalances. But I think when the world realizes the predicament that we're in, when the Fed cannot deliver the rate hikes that have been anticipated, when they end up expanding rather than contracting their balance sheet, and when people realize that this is an indefinite expansion, QE infinity, and there's no way to restrain inflation, then I think there's going to be a crisis in the dollar. I think the dollar will cease to function really as a reserve currency. And that will complete the process that began in the 70s. And this could be an even more bullish environment for gold.
But under this scenario you've outlined, shouldn't there really be a go-to reserve currency? Are you predicting then that the yuan, certainly not the euro, which has been struggling?
I think they'll go back to gold. I mean, why do they have to substitute another flawed fiat currency for the dollar? One of the reasons that a lot of people use currencies as opposed to gold is because of convenience, right? I mean, it's easier to transact in dollars or euros or yen than it is to transact in gold bullion, right? People have their gold, they store it in their house, but if they want to actually spend it, it's much more difficult. But that's not even true anymore. I mean, you take a company like Gold Money, which I'm now involved in. I mean, Gold Money allows individuals to earn, save, spend, transact in gold as easily as they can in currency. In fact, easier. Right? Anybody can go to goldmoney.com and open up an account online. It takes a few minutes, and then they can turn whatever quantity they want of dollars or euros or yen into gold. They can use their MasterCard or Visa, American Express, or they can do a bank transfer, and they can buy some gold. And now they own the gold, and it's stored in a vault for them. They can choose where they want it vaulted, but you can buy any quantity that you want, and then you can use that gold. You can spend any portion or gift any portion of the gold that you want to any person you want or any company you want anywhere in the world instantaneously. You know, you can make transfers for free to other individuals who can transfer to somebody else for free. You know, there's small merchant charges if people want to be a merchant, but you can set your business up so that your suppliers or people that pay you are going to pay you in gold. Either they can pay you directly in gold, or their fiat currency can be converted instantaneously to gold as they pay you. So using the internet, you know, a company like Gold Money actually takes gold, the safety and the store value of gold, and makes it as convenient, if not more so, than government-created money for commerce. And so I think as people start to lose confidence in the dollar or other fiat currencies, more and more people will convert their savings into gold. And with the technology of Gold Money, you know, they can utilize their gold in their daily lives. You don't even need a bank account anymore. I mean, when you have a Gold Money account, you can get a debit card. Soon you'll be able to get check writing. So if you can get a debit card that's attached to your gold holdings, if you can get a checkbook where you can write checks against your gold holdings, what do you need a bank account for? Why do you have to hold any fiat currency? People can have their income their paychecks directly deposited into gold. And then if your landlord will accept, you know, gold in payment of rent, well, fine, you know, and, you know, you can just pay all your bills in gold. I mean, believe me, if I was a landlord, I'd want my tenants to pay me in gold. Why not? I'd rather get paid in gold.
Sure, theoretically, it's great. But you have to wonder, though, as big of a proponent as I am for Bitcoin, Litecoins, Ethereum, all of the crypto alternatives, the thing that I think is keeping some people up at night is the worry that, you know, politicians and policymakers can, at the stroke of a pen or a key, I guess it's a mouse click nowadays, change the playing field. I mean, look at India. People wake up, large bills are outlawed. That's something like 86-90% of their economy evaporates.
That's another reason to prefer gold. I mean, it's harder for them to outlaw that. I mean, although it's certainly happened in the past. But, you know, the problem with the cryptocurrency is, of course, is you have to have faith that the cryptocurrencies will store value. We don't know that. They don't have a long history of storing value because they're just brand new, whereas gold has a 5,000-year history. It's pretty easy. I mean, would somebody, for example, would you take your life savings and turn it into Bitcoin? You don't know what it's going to be worth in 5 years or 10 years. It may be worth a lot. It may be worth nothing. But you have pretty good confidence that gold will always have value. And, you know, you can have, there's historic relationships between gold and other commodities. There's no historic relationships between Bitcoin or any of these coins and anything because they have such a short history of being in existence. But the thing about gold, why it's hard is, like, when you have an account with gold money, gold is your property. And so now you're dealing with property rights. And a lot of governments are not going to, you know, violate your individual property rights, your right to own property, because taking your gold in that is like just seizing your house or seizing your car or, you know, your other personal possessions. I mean, there are laws that protect private property. And so that's what's protecting people who own gold. Now, of course, you know, countries go communist and, you know, they seize private property, but, you know, when that happens, we're going to have a lot more to worry about. I mean, you know, certainly your paper currency will be worthless too under the circumstances where the governments are trying to seize private property.
We really appreciate James Turk's gold money. I mean, he's been a huge friend of the show for quite some time, a remarkable business plan they have there, and it's working very well. But I would just make a couple of quick comments about cryptocurrency, in particular about Bitcoin. You know, I think folks forget the fact that thousands of Bitcoins are lost each year. There is just a fixed number, unlike every currency currently in the world that has virtually no gold or silver backing. They can print as much as they like into existence, theoretically at least. That blockchain is fixed in the Ethernet.
You do have a cap on the supply, right? But there's the other factor is demand. And the question is, you know, will people always want Bitcoin, or may they want something else, and may the demand for Bitcoin plunge because somebody comes up with a better mousetrap? I mean, so since gold has actual physical properties, since gold is desired outside of its monetary function, right, there's always going to be people that want to use gold, whether it's for jewelry or whether it's for electronics or whether it's for medicine or all the various uses for this very rare element, right? Those uses will exist beyond whether or not people want gold as money. But the only reason for Bitcoin to exist is because people want to use it as money. And if people decide they don't want to use it as money anymore, then it has no other use. And so it's now worth nothing. So that's the risk that you take. You know, yes, you know, there's a limit to what the supply is, but if there's no demand, then it doesn't matter what the supply is. If the supply is worthless. So I'm just not worried about that happening with gold.
What I was really alluding to is more of a symbiotic-like relationship. If you could have transferred gold, okay, let's say converted it into Bitcoin or Litecoin, what have you, and sent it to New York or Chicago, San Francisco, and had it converted into gold when you got there.
But the thing is, today, you know, using gold money, you don't have to convert your gold into anything to send it across the world. You can be in Europe and you can send your gold to America instantaneously. You never have to convert it to anything. So that's the power of the platform, that you're taking gold and making it instantaneously transferable anywhere in the world, because you don't have to transport it. Because your gold, let's say you choose Zurich, and you're storing your gold in Zurich. It doesn't matter whether you're in Japan or Australia or Canada. I mean, the gold's sitting there in Zurich, but you can access it from anywhere in the world. You can spend it from anywhere in the world. You can direct it to anyone you want. So you don't have to move it around. The gold is stationary, but you're portable. You're mobile, but you can spend it. So it's the reason that governments were able to get people to use paper is they made it more convenient than lugging around bars of gold. But the internet now makes it even more convenient to use gold. It's actually cheaper. If I wanted to send you a tenth of an ounce of gold right now, I can do it cheaper than sending you $100. Right? I mean, it's easier. I can move it to you for free. If you had a gold money account, I can send it from my gold money account to your gold money account. It's free. How am I going to send you $100? I mean, I can put a $100 bill in the mail and send it to you. I mean, that'll take a little while. I got to buy a stamp. And if I wire it to you, my bank is going to charge me like $10 or $15, or if I send it by Western Union.
How do you address the anonymity factor that Bitcoin offers?
Look, yes. I mean, obviously, cash is anonymous, right? To the extent that I can put a $100 bill in the mail and send it to you, and that transaction is anonymous, right? So there are people that desire that quality. And Bitcoin, in a way, gives you that. But, since it's all on the internet, I'm not sure how anonymous it is, because, the government can track all the stuff we do online. So I know there's ways that, like, I can own a Bitcoin, and maybe I can write down the number of my Bitcoin on a piece of paper and hand it to you, and maybe I can transfer it to you in an anonymous way. But I think the way most people deal in Bitcoin, where you're using your computer, I'm pretty sure the government can track everything you're doing. It's not going to end up being that anonymous to the government. I mean, it might be anonymous, I mean, if I decide that I'm going to spend my Bitcoin, it may be anonymous to you that I've done that. But ultimately, the big brother, I think they'll be able to crack down. And I do think that a lot of people who potentially are utilizing cryptocurrencies in a way that helps them avoid taxes may find themselves with a pretty big tax bill, because the government will probably be able to go back and dissect a lot of these transactions and hit people with a lot of bills, because they don't like the fact that it's private, right? The government, that's one of the reasons they want to eliminate cash. They want to track everything we're doing.
I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about precious metal stocks. Our listeners are big aficionados of the yellow metal and silver companies. I'd like your thoughts here, whether we're overdone on the downside.
Well, I think the reaction to the election, the sell-off in gold stocks, is way overdone, because the idea, again, that inflation, higher inflation, is bad for gold is just completely ridiculous. That's exactly why people want to own gold, and an increase in inflation is going to be beneficial to gold, and obviously it's going to be beneficial to the companies that own it and are mining it and selling it, and people should take advantage. We have our own gold fund, the Euro Pacific Gold Fund, EPGFX is the symbol. Aaron Day is my sub-advisor. That fund, I believe, Morningstar had me ranked as the top gold fund for the first half of this year, and as of today, I believe we're the number two fund. It is about 70 gold funds that we track, and I think we're number two performance. So I think Adrian is doing a great job. We have a really good portfolio of mining companies, and it's very difficult on your own, especially if you want to get into the junior mining sector. We have a good portfolio there to know the real value from the frauds. There's unfortunately not everybody in the business is honest, and not every gold mine is worth anything. So you got to really know what you're doing if you're going to go into the juniors. If you're just going to buy the major companies, I mean, yeah, you could just buy the big blue chip companies and, you'll make money, I think. But if you want to get, some of the smaller ones, let a professional pick those stocks for you. And we're doing a good job in the Euro Pacific Gold Fund. So that's one way for people to really, I think, participate in what I believe is going to be a huge bull market, is to own my gold fund. EPGFX is the symbol. People can buy it pretty much anywhere. Check your prospectus, make sure it's suitable. You can withstand the risks. And people could also buy it if they have an account with me, at my company, Euro Pacific Capital. My brokers, can buy the fund for you. This is professionally managed. And, I think that we add value as managers. I don't think just blindly buying and holding an index, is the best way to go. I think that we could, we could look at these stocks objectively and decide which ones are the best. And we can also decide when a stock might be expensive relative to another stock, and we can sell one position and buy another stock. I think doing that, using your brain, is going to long-term deliver higher returns than just mindlessly owning an index. You know, I think for, you know, some people think that that's all you need, right? Just, you know, that somehow, you know, you can't beat the market. But I think that over the long run, the market is pretty easy to beat. And, you know, so it's kind of easy to beat them if you're disciplined and you know what you're doing.
Any other contact information you'd like to leave today?
Yeah, well, people, you know, don't forget, I'm constantly doing stuff on the internet, my YouTube channel, The Schiff Report, schiffradio.com, my podcast, you know, check out my books. You know, my latest one is still, I think, very relevant, The Real Crash, America's Coming Bankruptcy, How to Save Yourself and Your Country. And, you know, go to the website, shiftgold.com or Europac Capital, europac.com. Sign up for my, you know, newsletters or my all the reports that we put out, and make sure you're on my mailing list. You know?
We want you to have an excellent 2017.
You too.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves, industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank. And founding director, their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Well, my featured guest today says the economic collapse of 2008 and 2009 really led to a great recession that may still be underway. There just hasn't been the recovery reported by the mainstream media outlets. John Williams from Shadow Stats joins us on this holiday. Happy Thanksgiving, John Williams.
Well, and a happy Thanksgiving to you, too. Thank you so much for having me.
You've really disseminated some fascinating information. This would have some folks burned at the stake a few generations ago. According to your work, if you can believe the headline numbers, unemployment in this country, national unemployment, peaked at around 10% during the Great Recession, and since then has slowly declined to under 5%. I think it was 4.8 or 4.9 at last look. You're not convinced of this. Your numbers say that the alternative unemployment measure, which counts discouraged and displaced workers, actually remained static at around 20 to 23%. It impacts every level of the economy. Give us the implications of your work.
I've been a private consulting economist for 30 plus years, and early on I found I had to get a real solid idea as to what the government was doing with their numbers in order to give meaningful forecasts to my clients. What I found over time was that what the government was reporting, those numbers were diverging. Over time, I found that basically Main Street USA has a lot better idea of where economic reality is than the headline economic statistics. A lot of it is how you define the numbers. with the unemployment rate, it's very specifically a matter of definition, where the headline unemployment rate, the one that right now is down at what some on the Fed are claiming is a full employment level of 5%, roughly 5%. That's nonsense. The way they define it, it's a measure of, to be counted as unemployed, you have to be out of work and you have to have been actively looking for work in the last 4 weeks. It's a matter of definition. To be counted as unemployed, in the headline numbers, you have to obviously be out of work, but you also have to have been actively looking for work in the last 4 weeks. If you haven't been actively looking for work, let's say you've been unemployed for 6 months and you're just not finding any jobs and you give up looking for, but you still want a job, the government considers you a discouraged worker. It's a term they use. And they'll put you in a separate category that takes you out of the headline labor force. The headline labor force, when you look at how they calculate the unemployment rate, the labor force is just the number of employed plus the number of unemployed. And the unemployment rate's the number of unemployed divided by the labor force. So if you're counted as unemployed and a part of the labor force and the unemployment rate's at 5%, that's a much lower level of unemployed count than I see. And the guy who's been unemployed for a period of time and has stopped looking, he just drops out. Drops out of the government's numbers. Now, they'll count him for a while in the government's broadest unemployment measure. They have six measures called U6. And there he'll be counted a year as a discouraged worker, but after a year, he's no longer counted as a discouraged worker. Just dropped from that. The difference is right now that the headline unemployment's around 5%. The U6, which is the broadest government measure, is around 10%. But once they drop out of the headline measure, and the same thing happens after a year, they're discouraged, they're no longer counted. Well, back before 1984, when they changed the system around, and that's because we were getting NAFTA put into place, and there was a lot of expectation that it was going to cost people jobs, and it wouldn't be too good a political idea to show the real long-term discouraged workers, so they changed the way they defined the series. If you add back in the long-term discouraged workers, the displaced workers, occasionally in economic downturns as we've had, I estimate it's up around, the unemployment rate right now is up around 23%. Putting that in perspective, I'll contend that if you went around the country was unemployed, that's about the number you'd get. It's because of the underlying reality there, the economy is worse than what the government's reporting. Probably more so than anything else that gave us the political overthrow we've just seen in the presidential race. Mr. Trump picked up on the fact that people responded, and he's now the president-elect. What's happening here? Back in 92, George Bush was running for re-election. The economy had been in a recession, and there were people associated with the administration who went out and GDP numbers, boosted the GDP. The recession ended. Hip, hip, hooray, except that nobody believed it. George Bush didn't get reelected. Economic well-being, the pocketbook issues, more than anything else, tend to drive presidential elections. And you can see that when it's been below generally 3%, when the real disposable income has been below 3%, adjusted for inflation. The incumbent party has always lost the White House. That's since 1932 when you have the first numbers. Other issues, of course, here other than just the employment. You have the payroll employment. You have that's probably more of a market driver than the unemployment rate. It's a survey that's conducted of industry in terms of how many people they have on payrolls. So that if someone actually has a part-time job or two part-time jobs or three part-time jobs where the payroll gets reported to the government, they're counted three times as being household survey where you only get counted once, irrespective of how many jobs you're holding down. So when you see a surge in payrolls, that sometimes reflects more people taking on multiple jobs. But they also have upside bias factors that were added into that system back in the 80s, in the coming out of the 1983 recession. The Bureau of Labor Statistics was in an embarrassing political situation where they actually underestimated the number of jobs being created coming out of that recession. So what they did was they put in what they called a bias factor, adding in about 160,000 jobs per month for good measure, so they didn't have to worry about understating the employment. And that varied some over time, and as they received some criticism on it, they formalized the model. Now it's called the birth-death model, but basically it's a fudge factor, adding a couple hundred thousand jobs a month in there to, for good measure, to keep the numbers on the plus side. The GDP. Now that's the broadest measure of the U.S. economy. It's what most people will follow. You say, what's the economy doing? They'll look at the GDP and say, oh, here's what the GDP's doing. Well, it's the broadest measure of the economy. It's currently published. But it is very heavily politicized, very heavily gimmicked, very heavily modeled. If you believe the GDP reporting, the economy crashed from late 2007, collapsed into 2009, and then rebounded. And it now stands about 13% above where it was before the recession, above the prior peak in the economy before the recession. That's adjusted for inflation. That's the way they normally look at it. The problem is there's nothing else that's showing that. If you look at industrial production, which accounts for roughly 65% of the GDP, right now that's down something like 1.5% from its pre-recession peak. The manufacturing sector there is down 6% from its pre-recession peak. Never recovered. Retail sales are higher. And there's some reasons for that, basically poor quality and adjustment for inflation. But even there, with the spike numbers, they're up 5% from the pre-recession peak. You look at elements such as the cash freight index, broad measure of freight activity, broad measure of economic activity. It's down year to year, still falling. You look at housing. You're down, depending upon the measure, anywhere between 30% and 60% from the pre-recession peak. Very difficult to come up with that kind of growth that they're advertising in the GDP. And as a result, most people don't believe the GDP numbers. They also think that inflation is understated, and they're correct. Again, it's a matter of definition. And in this case, you had a very open effort by the government to understate inflation. Changes that were made go back to the 1980s, but where it came before the public was in the 1990s with Alan Greenspan, and who headed a commission with his name. The way Greenspan explained it was that the CPI overstated inflation. And if only it stated inflation correctly, it would save the government a lot of money because it wouldn't have to pay as much in cost of living benefits for things such as Social Security. It would also push people into higher tax brackets so they'd pay higher income taxes. Well, if you ask them, what are you talking about? And how is it overstating inflation? The example he'd give is, well, suppose steak gets very expensive. People buy more hamburger instead of steak. Their cost is not going to be as high, therefore their cost of living is less, but that's not reflected in the CPI. Well, this is where you get into definition, because that is indeed a matter of definition. Additional consumer price indices, and this is the way it was up until they started changing these numbers, measured what's referred to as maintaining a constant standard of living. If you want to use a CPI measure to estimate how much your income has to increase by, or what you're targeting your investment return at in order to stay ahead of inflation, you want to be able to do so so that you don't have to cut back on your standard of living. You want to be able to maintain your standard of living consistent with, at least with what's happening in inflation. And if you have to cut back on steak because it's getting too expensive relative to hamburger and buy more hamburger, that's not maintaining a constant standard of living. So what they did was they moved to change the CPI to sort of a substitution-based index. It hasn't been done fully successfully yet. They've made all sorts of gimmicked changes to the CPI, but they've also developed a new series called the CPI, the CCPI, the chained CPI, which in the not-too-distant future, we'll see what happens with the new government, but as it was planned, would become the new cost of living measure that would enable them to further cut cost of living adjustments for people on Social Security. If you're on Social Security and you don't think the payments that the increases you're getting cover your cost of living, you're absolutely correct. And it's designed that way basically to save the government money. The government is not putting out a more accurate CPI measure. It's not putting out a CPI measure in terms of what do I need to stay ahead of inflation. They just redefined it so that they'd come up with the smallest inflation possible that cut their expenditures. So you have factors like those. The inflation changes affect the reported growth rate. You look at the GDP, not as strong as advertised. One reason for that is that it has in it very low inflation numbers that are used in deflating the series. But you're looking at economic growth. You only want to look at it with inflation removed. And let's say you run a store and you look at your cash register and your sales are up 10% from last year. Well, if inflation's up 10% from last year, then you're basically break even after inflation. It's important to know what inflation is. If you deflate by too low a rate of inflation, it increases the inflation-adjusted growth rate. And right now we're seeing a general understatement inflation rate used in calculating the GDP. It's an aggregate number, about 2 percentage points, which happens to be just about what the GDP has been growing almost exactly year after year, quarter after quarter when you average it out. It's almost like someone was targeting 2% growth per year. The difference it makes and what I'll contend has happened here is that instead of the economy crashing from 2007 into 2009 and then rebounding, it started turning down late 2005, 2006, crashed indeed into 2009, and bounced off absolute bottom, but then it effectively leveled out at a low level of stagnation and never recovered, and now it's starting to turn down again. You'll see that again if you look at the housing numbers, you look at industrial production, you'll see it in a number of the broader employment measures that the government puts out, like the participation rate, which is also something along the lines of discouraged workers. You see rates there that are indicating that low level of participation in the workforce, low level of the population that's actually employed. These are the lowest levels seen basically since 1994, which is when they redefined the series. So that it's there are a number of factors that are confirming it out there. It's just that you just have to take the headline government numbers with a large grain of salt.
Exactly. No, we keep our grains of salt in dump trucks at goldseek.com. You brought up some really interesting points. I'd like to underscore at least one of them that I think has broad-based implications for all of our listeners today. And this will be a bit repetitive, I think, for our longer-term listeners, but for new folks, it bears repeating. If inflation is understated, as I understand it, our GDP deflator is also incorrect. So it appears as though, according to the official numbers, that the economy might be in recovery and the recession is in the rearview mirror. But when we look at the shadow stats numbers that have been at least theoretically corrected, more realistic, plausible inflation numbers, you immediately see that we've been in a recession for approximately 15 years, that meaningful work is more difficult than ever to find, and the actual recovery just seems to be the 1/10 of 1%.
The other side of that is basically lost some of his what used to be very strong employment opportunities. And a good deal of that is tied to trade deals. Again, this brings you back to some of the current issues that are being discussed in Washington, and factors that, again, helped Mr. Trump in his campaign were the reasonably easy time identifying with the problem. The problem with the trade deals. Free trade is a wonderful concept, and I love people in academia, but the problem of some of the theories they come up with is that they're handling such complex areas that they have to make simplifying assumptions, and you got to look real closely at those simplifying assumptions because that can affect the way things evolve. And the simplifying assumption with the free trade concept is that you have, say, two countries that haven't been trading before, and one makes one product particularly with a particular efficiency, and the other country makes a different product with particular efficiency, and they open up trade, and most of the production of one product goes to the other country and the other to the other country, but overall you get greater aggregate production, greater wealth to the system, and it should be, in theory, a positive benefit to everyone. The underlying assumption is that you're at full employment, and that hasn't been the case here in a long time, nor has it been with most of our trading partners. And as a result, when you have that type of a circumstance, the benefit goes to the low wage operation, and that's why have seen factories shut down in the United States and move to the people who otherwise they maybe were a high paid machinist. Couldn't get a job, now they flip hamburgers. They may be employed, but they're not earning adequate income. What you'll find is that with the government's numbers, this is from the published by the Census Bureau, and they keep revising the numbers some. But if you look at their latest estimates, what was referred to as a median household income. This would be the middle level of income for the household in the United States, adjusted for their headline inflation, the CPI, CPIU. This is the one that most people follow. That adjusted for inflation, that median income now is below where it was back in the 1970s and 1980s. If you look at real average weekly earnings as published by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, peak was in 1973. It's been downhill from then. And it's the reason is largely tied to the loss of the domestic productive base offshore and the higher paying jobs offshore. And again, that's a reason that you've had such economic disgruntlement. And again, some overturn in the political system and criticism of the trade deals. There are legitimate concerns there.
Let's move on to the U.S. dollar. Of course, the greenback has broken out to multi-decade highs recently. Many in the mainstream are at least citing the potential for another rate hike or two in 2017. And of course, we're certainly going to see one in the December FOMC meeting, a quarter point at least. Do you believe that we will see higher rates in 2017 by our policymakers? And can you tell us just what that might mean for the domestic economy?
Yeah, I think there's a good chance the Fed's going to raise rates in December. The problem is they haven't done so other than back in December of 2015. They've been threatening it ever since. But they're bluffed. The problem is that the banking system collapsed back in 2008, the panic of 2008. What the Treasury, the federal government did, I mean the Treasury and the Fed, did was basically use whatever stopgap measures they could put together without consideration of the factors that had actually generated the crisis, but to buy time, to push the crisis into the future. What the Fed and the Treasury did with that crisis in 2008, they decided that they would save the banking system at all cost. They did whatever they had to do to keep the system afloat, to push the crisis into the future. They stopgap measures, whatever they had to bail out. They guaranteed whatever they had to guarantee, bailed out General Motors. They purchased AIG, the largest insurance company, bailed out the large banks. Whatever they had to do, they did. And they bought some time. But they did nothing to address the underlying issues. And the average country wants out of the U.S. Treasuries, not into them. Big buyers such as China, Japan, South Korea, they're all selling now. The biggest buyer had been the Federal Reserve. That's quantitative easing. I think they're not going to have much of a choice but to go back to that. Because where they talk about launching their quantitative easing programs to help stimulate the economy, that's nonsense. The quantitative easing programs were launched to try and preserve the liquidity of the banks, to bail out the banking system. They used the weak economy as political cover. But they knew that what they were doing with quantitative easing would never stimulate the economy. The funds were not going into the economy. They were going into the banks. They were buying out off bad assets and providing the banks with liquidity. If the economy continues to turn down, which it looks like it's doing, they're going to be seeing increased stresses on the banking system. I think they've already committed to, again, salvaging the system, not letting it fail, although it effectively failed in 2008. They're still going to do whatever they can to keep the banks from collapsing, which will mean more quantitative easing. And when they move towards more quantitative easing, irrespective of whether or not they raise rates in December, you'll start to see very heavy selling against the dollar, because it means we're going to have much higher inflation down the road. And that's going to be the long-term, that's going to be the long-term issue. The U.S. has got it, but whether the Trump administration, if they have all sorts of stimulus packages in hand, that's wonderful. But they have to get around the problems they have with the Fed. The Fed is not able to handle its current circumstance, and it has to do something to satisfy the rest of the world so people will want to continue investing in the United States, which means putting together some kind of a long-range package to guarantee the solvency of the United States over time. Right now, we have, including what they call unfunded liabilities, current value of that, the programs in hand, well in excess of $100 trillion. That's double the global economy. There's no way that can ever be paid off. The system has to be brought into balance. And that's not going to be easy. It's not necessarily even going to be a politically popular thing to do. But if you want to have a system where you can look to returning to normal interest rates, and I think, if you're borrowing money, nobody wants to pay higher interest rates. But if you're living on a fixed income, it was nice when you used to be able to get a return on your CD that was where it was not more efficient from a monetary standpoint to just go out and buy canned goods, because, again, goods are going to go up more in value over the next year than you're earning interest.
And, of course, we've also seen yields soar and bond investors panic, obviously ahead of the increased odds for a rate hike next year and higher rates to come in the United States.
I'm not looking at a normal economy here. I see some hope, of course, with the change in government. But I don't see – I mean, I'm hopeful that maybe something can be done, but frankly, I see the decades of living beyond our means and taking on obligations that could never be covered as being intractable.
Do you believe the globalists are setting up the new regime, because here we have the threat of higher rates, which is certainly not a positive for the housing market, not to mention, the equities markets.
The higher rates used to be normal. The issue here, though, what you've got to look at is a possibility here of a very dangerous inflation circumstance. That is set over time. I mean, if there's no change made to the obligations of the United States and our ability to meet them, eventually you're going to see a runaway inflation. That's just the effect of paying off things that you don't have covered otherwise with the money you've got to print to cover it. It debases the currency. You end up with a hyperinflation.
Right. In Venezuela, we're seeing one silver coin purchase $250 in groceries right now.
Well, that's the direction I'm afraid we're going in, even with the positive changes here. But however that goes, you need to be covered in that area. And the way an individual can protect himself is to buy physical gold and silver and hold it. I prefer sovereign coins because they're liquid. Have some of your assets in that. You can write out most anything. You also probably should have a stock of emergency supplies as you would for a natural disaster. This being a man-made disaster, get stuff that you can roll over the inventory on. But if we get into as difficult a time as I think we have ahead of us, and this very easily could be in the next year or two, if prices get out of control, if the currency becomes worthless, you don't know that deliveries are going to be made to grocery stores. How are you going to get gas out of gas stations that are denominated in a couple of bucks per gallon? There are all sorts of issues that come with it. Eventually, the system will adapt. It'll adjust. You might end up with a barter system for a while. I imagine you'll eventually end up with a new currency. But it's best to have a little bit of buy yourself a little bit of an insurance policy so that you can ride out the rough times.
Do you see any dislocations or things that investors should be watching for on the horizon?
Okay, looking at what investors should look at, follow the dollar. Look at the dollar. If it's you hear talk of heavy selling with the U.S. dollar, and coincident that would probably see some sharp rallying in price of gold and silver, I'd get very nervous. And I'd get, if you already don't have some, get some physical gold, but hold it through the crisis. It doesn't help you as a hedge. For example, you buy the gold. Let's say you buy gold at $1,100 or $1,200, where you are now. Gold gets up to $10,000 an ounce. What the gold does is it preserves the purchasing power of the money that's put into it. And if you're going to end up in a system where the dollar, let's say, becomes worthless, you want to hang on to that gold until the system has resolved itself. Because what might be 10,000 in gold could become 100,000 gold, could be 100 million, who knows? But it's not, what it does is, again, is it preserves the existing purchasing power. It keeps your assets from becoming worthless, which they would if you just held them in paper.
Very good. All right, John Williams, we appreciate you taking time today during this holiday. And while feeling under the weather, any other contact information you'd like to leave with the listeners?
Yeah, I think you got it, shadowstats.com. Always happy to hear from people looking at the site and interested in what we're doing.
John Williams, we appreciate your thoughts. Please feel better soon. We look forward to hearing more from ShadowStats in 2017.
Again, thanks for having me, Chris.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity. Brazil Resources, based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves. Industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank, and founding director. Their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers. producers, plus their REIA project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond. Your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
GoldSeek.com Radio. An article released this week by ABC, as in the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, discussed how the bond market is suggesting that interest rates have hit bottom. Their summary of the bond market describes it by stating, "Bonds are known as fixed interest or coupon securities, because the dollar amount of the interest is fixed when the bond is issued. For example, if a bond is worth $1,000 and the coupon or interest is $100, that is 10%. But if the price of the bond, when it is traded on the secondary market, goes down to, say, $500, that $100 coupon payment is now 20%. Described another way, an organization wanting to borrow that initial $1,000 would now have to pay $200 in interest, as opposed to the initial $100 of interest. The ABC article attributes comments by President-elect Trump regarding plans to rebuild inner cities, highways, bridges, tunnels, airports, schools, hospitals, and other infrastructure as having an immediate effect on global markets by wiping more than $1 trillion off the value of the global bond market. They believe the prospect of a debt-fueled, inflation-generating infrastructure spending spree, along with big cuts to U.S. tax rates, have raised the likelihood that interest rates are on the way up. According to a senior economist at St. George Bank, if inflation is going up and interest rates are going up around the world, we will be affected. We're an island, but not financially. And according to the chief investment officer of Watermark Funds Management, the 30-year rally in bonds is over. He describes that as a golden period, one of the longest rallies we have seen in any asset class. Bond rates ultimately affect the cost of money for everyone: car loans, home loans, credit cards, and yes, government borrowing. The ABC article seems to suggest that the possibility for bond market mayhem is somehow rooted in the election and infrastructure plans of President-elect Trump. History and government actions taken long before Donald Trump was a gleam in the public's eye for president are the real foundational cause of disruptions that may be about to occur as the game of extend and pretend loses momentum and effectiveness. My late friend Adrian Douglas wrote a prescient article following the 2008 economic collapse entitled "Bond Market Collapse is Imminent." Based on the economic circumstances at that time, before all the financial extend and pretend measures were put into place, which delayed the day of reckoning, Adrian wrote, by way of example, "Imagine a country, such as Venezuela, announced that it was bailing out an investment bank, then just days later said it was nationalizing its mortgage industry, and then just days later that it was bailing out its biggest insurance company, and then just days later its government pledged $700 billion to inject into its failing banks. And then, just days later, its stock market fell 20%. Would you feel comfortable having your money invested in such a country? In its stock market? In its bond market? Or in its currency? He continued by saying, I hope you answered no or hell no to the above question. So why should you feel any different about the situation if the country is called America? He went on to write, I am going to show you that the U.S. bond market is on the brink of collapse, and with it will come the collapse of the currency. Just as you would expect to be the outcome of such ridiculously inflationary policies in any other country. Fast forward to today, where in a recent CNBC article, the CFA Society, which polled 11,000 United Kingdom members employed in the investment industry, revealed that 82% of those polled contended global bonds are overvalued at current levels. The Band-Aids, bubblegum, scotch tape, and superglue that have been extending and pretending the illusion of a recovering economy the past 8 years may be about to give out. The financial reset button that I first discussed in one of my 2009 Goldseek commentaries concluded with the following thought. One of the unintended consequences of so many people out of work is they have the time to read, study, and educate themselves about what is happening and why. Change is coming, but it's not the kind of change most people thought they were signing up for. In 2010, most people and businesses will be forced in one way, shape, or form to hit the reset button on the American dream. I believe many did hit the reset button on their version of the American dream. And that change, which has for the most part been unacknowledged by mainstream media, in its typical deny and disown fashion, resulted in the monster vote and significant upset in this year's election. The roots of that change were planted long ago, in a financial crisis which has not ended. The media, the politicians, and the powers that be may just be waking up to changes and dislocations they have arrogantly ignored, which have dramatically impacted the development of this country and the world over the past 8 years. Any bond market mayhem or financial reset that may be approaching will not be rooted in the current plans of change in political administrations, but rather were planted and watered over the past 8 years. Making America great again may ultimately be measured in how the seeds of financial destruction are mitigated as we begin to reap what has been financially sown the past 8 years. Chris, I'd like to direct our listeners to visit my website at conquerchange.com and sign up for my new email list. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with conquerchange.com. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week. The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves, industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank, and founding director. Their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond. Your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice. GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.